except one line. Let's not talk ourselves. Let's be careful that we don't talk ourselves into being just another denomination. And I'll leave it for the time right there, okay? Because it is possible to be the Lord's church. We're in Romans chapter 4. This whole thing flows really well, and if you understand the flow of it, you understand you don't have to take verses out of their context. When you take a verse out of its context, it becomes a pretext. And so we don't want to do that. So if we keep in mind the flow, 1:18 to 3:20 talks about why we're lost. 3:21 to the end of chapter 5 talks about how we're saved. Or if you like it, the first part talks about how somebody tries to be saved by keeping law. And the result is we end up lost. And then we pick up with a completely different way of being made righteous. And so, in a sense, the whole Bible is about two different ways to be made righteous. One is you can earn it by keeping law. The other is it's imputed. And so righteousness is either earned or it's imputed. It's not a hybrid system between the two. And therein lies probably what I feel like might need to be addressed among us as much as anything. Because we've given up works for part of our salvation, but if we're not careful, we'll feel like we have to complete it by works. Paul will write the Galatians a letter because that's exactly where they were. And he said, what in the world makes you think that did you start by works of law? Is that how you got yourself saved? And the obvious answer that even they knew was no. That's not how we got saved. Then he said, well, why do you think you can stay saved? Why do you think now you can save yourself by going back to law and keeping law? You can't anymore keep yourself righteous than you could make yourself righteous. And we have to keep saying this a lot of different ways. And we have to keep coming back and touching some bases and reminding ourselves, law's not a, he's going to do this. I just want to make sure that we keep our minds in the vein that he's going to move us in. We get this attitude, then if that's true, then law is a bad thing. No, law's not a bad thing. Law's a really good thing. It just has its place and its purpose and its design. And when you take something out of its context and the purpose for which God designed it and try to make it do something that God never intended it to, then it becomes a bad thing. And it's not a bad thing unless we use it in the wrong way. And law, in fact, we'll pick it up here when we get on down into this section, but when we got to Romans chapter 3, Verse 20, then he drew a conclusion, therefore no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing law. And we keep coming back, and that's one of the bases. And along the way, as we're studying the first 8 chapters of Romans, there are places that you need to drive a peg that you keep coming back to and keep coming back to and keep coming back to. And you need to highlight it or circle it or underline it in red or do something to make yourself keep coming back to chapter 2, chapter 3, verse 20. No one is going to be declared righteous in his sight by observing law. And we need to keep on saying that until it begins to sink in. And now we've taken something away, we've cleared some ground, and now we're going to put something back. And the interesting thing is we hold on to our belief until somebody rips it away from us, don't we? And that's not a bad thing. I don't want you to give up anything because I said it. Me saying it's not good enough. But any time the Lord takes something away from you, He's got something much, much, much better to give you in its place. And that's what this is. And so you can be assured that what God has to give you, if your security came from, and I'm going to say, you can use me for an example, okay? That in my life, there has been some amount of my life was spent that my security came from thinking that I was good. Knowing in my heart that I wasn't very good, but trying to be better than somebody else. And trying to keep law. And he's going to say a little bit later, law works wrath. And boy, ain't that the truth. It works wrath in lots of ways. One of the ways is that if I'm trying to be justified by law and you're trying to be justified by law, we're not going to be very good friends. We may act like it when we're together, but we're in competition. And whenever the bear gets after me, I don't have to be able to outrun him. I just have to be able to outrun you. I have to be better than you. And we spend our lives, in some ways, trying to be better than others. If not in reality, then by criticizing others and tearing others down and trying to make ourselves feel better than others. Law really does work wrath. I don't think we really understand how true that is. But now that he said no one's going to be declared righteous in his sight by observing law, then he's taken away the little bit of security that I had. Because I didn't have much, but that's all I had. And so I'm now just left without anything. Until the next verse, he says, but now righteousness from God apart from law is made known, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. A righteousness from God apart from law is made known. That's what he's going to give me. And instead of an earned righteousness, he's going to give me an imputed righteousness. He's going to share with me, God has devised a way to make me as righteous as he is. And that's not heresy. That's the gospel. He clothes me with his very own righteousness. Man, if that's true, that's incredibly good news, isn't it? And so, from here on through chapter 8, he's going to be shoring up that statement. He's going to be trying to prove to you that that statement is true. That there is a righteousness that's from God apart from works of law. And it's available to you. And I've said before that I think chapter 3, verse 21 through 31, in my mind, is the most concentrated section of Scripture in the entire New Testament. And you can say the entire Bible, at least from my opinion. Because he just boils it down to a kernel right there, to the very heart of it. And when you go through it about four or five times, it begins to sink in. And we begin to understand it. But the conclusion that he's going to draw from that is, the next place where you want to drive a peg and underline or circle or highlight or whatever you're doing, those concluding statements, is in chapter 3, verse 28. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from observing law. So he's taken away what we had, what we were trying to do, trying to be righteous by keeping law, and said nobody's going to be declared righteous in his sight by law. And then the next step is, a man is justified by faith apart from observing law. There is a righteousness that is made available, but it's by faith apart from works of law. And that's, now he's going to spend, actually from here on to chapter 8, he's going to spend proving that. And so he's going to start in chapter 4 by going back and giving an illustration of somebody that not very many people, probably nobody in his audience there, and probably nobody in this audience here, or very few if any, would question whether or not Abraham went to heaven. I mean, that's one thing. There are lots of things we don't necessarily agree on, but we probably all agree that Abraham probably went to heaven, right? And so he goes back and he takes Abraham as an example, and he's going to show how was Abraham made righteous. What does Abraham, chapter 4, verse 1, what shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, discovered in this matter? What matter? This matter about being made righteous by faith apart from works of law. What did Abraham say about that? Well, first of all, verse 1 through 8, Abraham's righteousness was by faith and not by works. And he'll talk about if a person works, then his wages are not counted, not given as a gift, but an obligation. And so if you're made righteous by law, then don't talk about grace. Grace has no part in it. And if you're made righteous by grace, then what are you doing dragging law into it? But you see, we want some of each. We've given up some of our law righteousness, but maybe we've not given it all up. And so he's using Abraham as an illustration in 1 through 8. He says Abraham's righteousness was by faith and not by works. Now, we've been over that about 3 times, and I'd like to go over it again because we just need to be reminded, but I'm not. We've got to move at some point. So let's go down to verse 9 and pick up his second point. Not only was Abraham's righteousness by faith apart from works, but it was apart from, it was by grace and not by law. Is this blessedness, I'm in verse 9, is this blessedness, what blessedness? Look back at verse 7 and 8. Blessed are they whose offenses have been forgiven, sins have been covered. Blessed is the man whose sins the Lord will never count against him. Is that blessedness? That's some blessedness, isn't it? That's justification and sanctification, getting saved and staying saved. Is this blessedness only for the circumcised or for the uncircumcised? Who is it available to? Why would he ask that question? Well, then he continues and tells you why he asked that question. Because we used Abraham as an illustration. We have been saying that Abraham's faith was credited to him as righteousness. Was Abraham circumcised? Yes, Abraham was circumcised. He was the one that God made the covenant of circumcision with, right? But, when was Abraham declared righteous? Before he was circumcised or after he was circumcised? That's the question that he asked, verse 10. He says, under what circumstances was it credited? It what credited? It righteousness. Under what circumstances was righteousness credited to Abraham? Was it after he was circumcised or before? Now, why do you think he's making this argument? What has this got to do with anything? What is he proving? Okay, or make it a means, that's right, that you have to be circumcised in order to be saved, right? That's the point that their Jew would make. He said, yeah, I believe it's by faith, but you've got to be circumcised in order for that. And so he goes back to Abraham, and he said, let's see how Abraham was justified. And then he brings up circumcision, because if you had asked the Jew of this day, when you die, are you going to heaven? He'd say, yes, I'm going to heaven. Why do you think so? Well, because I'm a child of Abraham, because I've been circumcised, and because I keep the law. And so he's going to take each one of these. He says, was his righteousness, was it credited to him before he was circumcised or after? He says, it was not after, but before. And if you want to chronologically go back, Genesis chapter 15 is where the Bible says God saw Abraham's righteousness and credited it, or saw his faith and credited it to him for righteousness. He was circumcised chronologically, and this is in chronological order, in chapter 17, verse 11. And so you can write Genesis 15, 6, it's where it was declared that he was righteous. 17, 11 is where he was circumcised, which was later, chronologically later. That being true, what did circumcision have to do with his being made righteous? Now, we say nothing, and that's the right answer. But what if God had told him to be circumcised and he said, no, I don't think so? Then what? He wouldn't be walking by faith anymore, would he? That's the point. It's not that the circumcision had any efficacy within itself. It is his trust in God. It's what God saw and credited that righteousness. And the same thing we'll see on down later whenever God told him to, how about when God told him to get up from his home country and to go to a place where he would show him? What if Abraham had said, no, I don't think I want to do that. I've got a crop planted here and I got to wait till after harvest to go and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And look at how much trouble that'd be. And, you know, I've got this and I've got this. And what if he had worked, talked himself out of it? Would Abraham have been declared righteous? No. Why? Because he quit walking by faith. And what if God had told him to go sacrifice his son? He said, are you kidding me? God, you said that this boy right here is the one that you're going to make all these promises come true. I'm not going to kill that boy. I would make you be unrighteous if I did that because you told me that this was going to happen through this boy. And so, no, I'm not going to do that. What would happen to Abraham? He wouldn't be walking by faith, would he? And so it is these things, this faith, this trust in God that leads you to obey, that when God sees that, he credits that as righteousness. He says, and he received circumcision as a sign and the seal of the righteousness that he, look at the next word, he had, past tense, he already had it. So, circumcision was a sign and seal of what? Righteousness that was already there, right? That he had while he was still uncircumcised. So then he is the father. Here's the result of that. You tell me what the result of that is. The fact that he was declared righteous before he was circumcised. That means that Abraham can be what? The father of everybody. Everybody. Even if you're not circumcised. Right? Is that what that passage says? That's what that passage says, isn't it? That's what the argument that he's going to make. So then he is the father of all, number one, all who believe but have not been circumcised in order that righteousness might be credited to them. And he's the father of, secondly, the circumcised who not only are circumcised but who walk in the footsteps of faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. So Abraham is the father of the faithful. Abraham is your father if you're a Christian, just as much as he is the physical Jew's father. He is your father and my father. By what? By faith. By faith. Okay, we got a microphone you need to talk to.
How would you respond if someone came up with the question, yes, but Abraham was tested by a work.
What way was tested by a work?
With a work. Isaac, the sacrifice of Isaac.
Yeah. I'm not sure what kind of answer I would need to have. I would agree with that. He was. And it very well could be that same thing today, that there are some things that don't make very much sense to us that God tells us to do. And so, in a sense, we're tested also. I think our faith is constantly put to a test.
We are
tested. Yeah. Am I going to trust in my money in the bank, or am I going to trust in God? Am I going to, you can just keep on. I think our faith is put to the test every day. And, I would selfishly hope that my faith would never be put to that same level of test that was, because that was an incredible. And he's going to talk about that more down here in verse 18, the few verses that follow that. I wouldn't argue with that at all. I think it all along the way, we have the opportunity to quit walking by faith any moment we choose to. We can start relying on ourselves anytime we want to. And there's a real temptation to do that, and that's one reason that we need to keep coming back and studying this. And keep coming back and keep coming back and keep coming back. Because there are lots of things in the world that would pull us to trust in ourselves rather than in God.
Which is where a lot of denominations come from, because they start relying on themselves more than on God.
Yeah. Okay. The comment was that that's why That's where lots of denominations come from, because they start trusting in themselves rather than in God. And individually also. And we can start trusting in a series of acts, can't we? And that would be an example of where, you know, certain religious groups break off because we put our trust in some acts. Okay, now let's pick up in verse 13. He says, it was not through the law. By the way, it's not through circumcision. Was Abraham's righteousness was independent of circumcision? Does that mean that circumcision was not necessary? Circumcision was necessary, wasn't it? In fact, when Moses came along, God was laying in wait. He was going to kill him because he hadn't followed through on that circumcision thing, hadn't he? So that was important to God, wasn't it? But your salvation is not a matter of circumcision. In fact, he'll make an application of that. True circumcision is what? Of the heart, not of the flesh. What would that mean? That'd make a good study within itself, wouldn't it? The word circumcised means to cut around. Are there some things in our heart that we need to cut away from our heart? Yeah, there are some things. Before you can trust in God, there's some things you got to cut loose from. And sometimes we want them waiting in the eaves here. You know, we'll kind of push them away at arm's length, but we leave them here in case we need them. That's our fallback. And then in verse 13 through 22, it was not through law. It wasn't through circumcision. Not through law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise that he would be heir of the world. Now, he picks up a word promise here. And if you'll go to Galatians chapter 3, you'll find some parallel teaching here, because in Galatians chapter 3, he's going to have a lot to say about the fact that righteousness came as a result of promise. And the word promise becomes prominent in Galatians 3, and it's prominent right here. He picks up the concept of a promise. He said, it's not through law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise that he would be heir of the world. In other words, the blessings that God promised to give to Abraham came through what? A promise. Through your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed, back in Genesis chapter 12. But he says this promise did not come, and this is one of those really easy, self-evident things. It didn't come by law. Now, before we get into the argument, how do we know that? How do we know it didn't come through Moses' law? Let's put it that way. Because, did Abraham live under Moses' law? How do we know that? Come on, how do we know that Abraham didn't live under Moses' law? Yeah, Moses hadn't even been born. That law hadn't been given, right? So he couldn't live under Moses' law, could he? And he says, it's not through law that Abraham and his offspring received the promise that he'd be heir of the world, but through the righteousness that comes by faith. Now he's picking up a phrase now that he started out, and he says, We conclude that a man's not justified by works, but by the righteousness that comes by faith. The righteousness that comes by faith. The righteousness that comes by faith. For if those who live by law are heirs, faith has no value, and the promise is worthless. You just voided two things. If you're made righteous by law, you don't need faith. Why? The law is not of faith. Can you keep the law without any faith? Yes, you can. You don't have to trust anybody to keep law. And then he says, and the promise is worthless. Why is the promise worthless? Because if it's dependent on your keeping the law, then don't talk about a promise. It's the same concept as don't talk about grace. Because that has nothing to do with it. If it's because you deserve it, then a promise doesn't matter. You can claim it. You can stake your claim on it. Because law brings wrath. Now, we probably ought to camp out there for about a month and talk about different ways. I've already gone and touched some of it. One of the ways that it brings wrath is between persons who are trying to live under law. We're in competition with one another. After all, if it's under law, then only God's grade's on the curve and only 10% of us are going to make it there, and I got to figure out how to get in the top 10%. And I can enhance my chances of being in the top 10% by doing what? By kicking you out of it. Makes place for me. Now, I know that in our mind, we don't exactly say that, but in our actions, we do. Because have you known of Christians that are hypercritical? I mean, they just criticize everything and everybody. It's just automatically. They smell flowers and think of a funeral. You know, they just can't help themselves. Everything is negative. Everybody has to jump through my hoops. Everybody has to meet my standard. I'm the judge. I'm the one who determines. And you leave the worship assembly and you criticize everybody that had any part in it. You criticize a song leader. You criticize a person who took too long in a prayer. You criticize the preacher and you criticize everything. And it gets to be a habit. It gets to be a way of life. Why do we do that? Why do we do that? Because somehow it makes us feel superior. That's what criticism's about. It's to make me feel better. Now, is that kind of weird? Really, you stop and think about it. That's really, now, we would say, that's not why I criticize. Beg to differ. It is why. I know you'll never admit that, and neither will I. But that's why. Because it makes me feel better. Now, there's bound to be something wrong with me if criticizing makes me feel better. If constant criticism makes me feel better, there's probably something wrong in here. Wouldn't it be a lot better to be an encourager, to be positive? Wouldn't that be a better way to feel good about yourself? Well, I think that that's what the Bible teaches us that we need to be doing. But some of us, and particularly if we live by law, we feel this need, this necessity of bringing other people down so that we can be in that top percentage, whatever we think that percentage is. So, he says, where there is no law, there is no transgression. Now, that's a self-evident truth, isn't it? You can't transgress it if it's not there. But that goes a lot deeper. Sometime we'll stay on that one a little more. Let me give you a place to go to think some more about that. Go to chapter 5, verse 13. Chapter 5, verse 13. Before the law was given, and we'll get here, so I'm not going to take a long time explaining it. We'll pick it up when we get here. Before the law was given, sin was in the world, but sin is not taken into account where there is no law. Come back and read this. Where there is no law, there is no transgression. Turn one more place. Let me let you give you another one. Turn to Galatians chapter 5. And I try not to do this too often, but I think this one is worth it here to give you a little fodder to feed on. Galatians chapter 5, verse 16, beginning. So I say, live by the Spirit, and you'll not gratify the desires of your sinful nature. For the sinful nature desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to the sinful nature. They're in conflict with each other, so that you do not do what you want. Look at verse 18. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are what? Not under law. If you're led by the Spirit, you are what? Not under law. Well, we don't know what to do with that, do we? Where there's no law, there's no transgression. Think about it. Think about that. If we're not justified by law, if our righteousness comes apart from law, where there's no law, there's no transgression, you might be getting an insight into how God keeps you righteous. You with me? Some of you are. Others of us, that scares. But the Bible tells me so. Where there's no law, there's no transgression. Can a person get out from under law and then go back to it? Sure they can. That's what Galatians was written for. These Christians had been delivered from law, from being made righteous by law. But there was something in them that kept pulling them to want to go back and be justified by law. What? Why? Yeah, lack of faith. And we never understood that we couldn't be justified by law. If we really ever understand that, we're not going to go back and try to be justified by law, are we? Why do we keep going back to law? What is there in us that just keeps wanting to hold on to that law? I mean, if we have tried to be justified by law, then that's a killer. There's a curse associated with being justified by law. What is it? Cursed is he that continueth not to do everything written in the book of the law. You got to do it all. And so if you go back to that law, the curse is still there. It's not only there for justification, it's there for sanctification. It's not only there for getting saved, it's there for staying saved. If you're going to stay saved and keep yourself righteous, and your claim to get to heaven once you become a Christian is that you're a good, righteous person, you keep the law, then you got the curse again. And you're going to have to deal with the curse. And the curse is, if you ever transgress it one time, you're dead. We need to learn that law. We need to learn that principle and not go back. Therefore, verse 16, the promise comes by faith. The promise comes by faith, so that it may be by grace. If it doesn't come by faith, it can't be by grace. And it may be guaranteed to all of Abraham's offspring. All of them. Not only those who are the law, but those who are the faith of Abraham. So, can you live under the law and be saved by faith? Wait. Can you live under the law and be saved by faith? Yes, you can. You cannot live by the law to be justified by faith, but you can live under the law. The Jews did. Jesus Christ did. They were under the law, right? But they didn't appeal to the law for their justification. Are you with me? And that's a point that we need to understand. Are we lawless people today? Do we appeal to law for our justification? No. But are we under law? We are under a law, but not for justification. We're under God's law. We're under the laws of the United States of America, and we are law-abiding people. Let it be known. We are the most law-abiding people in the whole world. But not to be saved. Because we already been saved. Why does the bird fly? Because he can. He don't have to prove to you that he can fly. He flies because he can fly. Why do we do good works? Not to be saved. But because God created us unto good works. That's what he made us for. As it is written, I have made you the father of what? Many nations. Not just one. If it was this circumcision thing and the law of Moses thing, then he would have been the father of one nation. But this blessedness that he promised to Abraham was separate from law. It was separate from circumcision, even though those things were required of him. It was by a promise. And he received it how? By faith. God made it available by grace as a gift, and he received it by faith. Salvation is by grace, through faith, apart from works of law. That's the gospel. As it is written, I've made you the father of many nations. He is our father in the sight of God, in whom he believed, the God who gives life to the dead and calls things that are not as though they were. Why do you think he put that little phrase in there? The God who gives life to the dead and calls things that are not as though they were. He wants to remind you. We constantly need to be reminded about this God. This God that we serve, he's worthy of serving. wow, is he worthy of serving? He gives life to the dead, physically and spiritually. And he calls things that are not as though they were. What does that mean? Yeah, he's not limited by time, and he can see all the way down to the end of time. In fact, Revelation chapter 13, verse 8 talks about what? The Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. Really? When was the Lamb slain? Somewhere around AD 30, 33, right in there, right? But in God's mind, he calls things that are not, hadn't happened yet, as though they were. And so he could go back to Abraham. He could go back to Isaac and to Jacob and to all of these people who walk by faith, and he could impute righteousness to them by grace through faith based on the cross. There's never been one single sin that's ever been forgiven apart from the cross of Jesus Christ. But he didn't have to wait for it to happen in order for it to be a reality. He calls the things that are not as though they were. And so he could act with absolute positive certainty with mercy and grace towards somebody under the patriarchal age, as it were, just as certainly as he can today after the cross. He could do it before the cross and forgive sins based on the cross, which hadn't happened yet. Wow. That's how people were forgiven under the old covenant. We've already been up and down those verses. Several verses in the Old Testament talks about God forgave sins in the Old Testament. He didn't have to wait for it to happen in order to forgive those sins. He did it on account, on the credit, as it were. And nobody could figure it out, not even angels, until Jesus hung on the cross. And then that last piece of the puzzle got put into place, and it made it all a beautiful tapestry. Now it made sense. It didn't make any sense before. God, as far as anybody else could tell, was just way out there operating somewhere and making some claims that nobody knew if they were really true or not, and he was taking these people to be with him in heaven, and nobody could figure out how, because God's righteous, and God can't coexist with sin, and there won't be any sin in heaven, and yet he was taking some sinners to be with him. How could that possibly be? You couldn't figure it out until him who knew no sin became sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And then it made sense. But God didn't have to wait. This God that we serve, he didn't have to wait till it happened to know it was going to happen. He gives life to the dead, and he calls those things that are not as though they were. And now, lest you think, sometimes one of the things that we feel whenever we're contemplating this concept of righteousness by grace through faith, as opposed to what some of us have believed, that it was through works of law, we get to thinking, man, this can't be true. It's just too easy. This is too easy. Really. If you want it to be hard, if I were to ask you, this new way of being made righteous, this imputing righteousness, is it easy or hard? You could say it any way you want to say it. You could say it's easy, you could say it's hard. I guess it depends on your perspective. It's one thing it is, it's possible, whereas before under law it was impossible. But is it easy when God tells you to take your son and take him to a place and put him on an altar and take his life? Would you call that easy? This faith thing. This is the greatest challenge you're going to ever have in your life, to learn to trust God and quit trusting yourself. Really? That's what we're all about here, is trying to help one another develop faith. I mean, if you really want to boil what this assembly is all about, that's the heart of what the purpose of this assembly. That's why we study our Bibles together. It's why we sing. It's why we have fellowship with one another, so that we can encourage each other to trust God. Because, man, that's hard. It's a lot easier to trust a couple of $1 million in the bank, isn't it? And feel secure because of that. But to be able to feel secure when your health has failed and when you're not quite sure where your next meal is coming from, whoa, is that easy? This faith thing, this is the greatest challenge you're ever going to have. And sometimes we make a claim when in fact we're trusting in the fact that my freezer is full of food, rather than trusting in God. Is it really hard to put your heart into praying, give us this day our daily bread? Is it hard to really get your heart into saying that? Only if you don't realize that everything can be taken away in a heartbeat. That everything that you have is a gift from God. Everything. And when you think you're in control, you ain't. You're not in control. And we see that every day, don't we? I mean, people that's got everything, they worked their whole life to get things the way they want them, and all of a sudden they get word they got cancer. Wow. This faith thing is hard. And we need one another to help. We need to be with people that are struggling to trust God like we are. God, help my unbelief. Is there anybody here that feels like you've got a perfect faith? That you don't ever have any doubts or fears or concerns? I wish I could say I was there. I'm a lot further down the road than I was a few years ago. But I still get a little nervous sometimes about some things. And I still dread the idea of certain things happening in my life or in my children's life and so forth. And so he says, against all hope, Abraham in hope believed, and so became the father of many nations. Just as it has been said to him, so shall your offspring be, many nations. Without weakening in his faith, he faced the fact that his body was as good as dead since he was about 100 years old and Sarah's womb was also dead. So, when God told him he was going to have a child, everything... By the way, was that a miraculous birth? Was Isaac a miraculous birth? Well, if Sarah's body was dead, if she had, we're all adults here, aren't we? If she had gone through menopause, she couldn't have children. She could not have children. Was that birth a miraculous birth? Wait, were there miracles in the Old Testament? Sure there were miracles. I'm not asking, was it a virgin birth? We don't have to be afraid of that, okay? I'm saying, was it a miraculous birth? Yes, it was. She couldn't have children. Everything, when God said, your wife, Sarah, is going to have a son, every day when he woke up, the first thing he thought about was, how hard is this is? Is this hard to believe? That she's going to have a child whenever she's past her childbearing years? 10 years of that. You tell me faith is easy? This thing of faith is hard. Can you believe? This is a God who raises the dead and calls things that are not as though they were. Keep remembering that, okay? Is God's arm short? Is anything too hard for God? You really believe that? We need to keep asking ourselves that, and we'll stop right there and pick up, Lord willing, next week. Thank you.